and welcome to Worlds Apart. The 80th anniversary of the victory in World War II has made the interplay between history and contemporary politics all the more precarious, leaving some of the former allies at loggerheads, each celebrating their own truth and fighting their own evil. What does it portend for European security going forward? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alexander Hill, professor of military history at the University of Calgary in Canada. Professor, it's great to see you again. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time. Now, you are a big specialist in Soviet military and political history, especially the Great Patriotic War, as World War II is known here in Russia. I wonder if your understanding of this war, of its place in Russia's history, its place in Russia's collective psyche, its culture, whether it has changed over the last 3 years as Russia entered into the active phase of war in Ukraine.
There's been a digging in Russia in the last few years that's perhaps similar to the Great Patriotic War. You know, there was a shock at the beginning of the Great Patriotic War for the population. And after that, I think there was a sort of psychological digging in. And I think that's what happened in Russia, particularly, you know, I was here for the first time after February 2022 in November, and I could almost feel that psychological digging in. So in that sense, I think there is a similarity between the Great Patriotic War in a psychological sense and the special military operation.
That war took 5 years to the Russians. Well, actually, a little bit less. This one is already going into the fourth one. I know historians don't like using crystal balls, no. But do you think this campaign will be over before it marks the 5-year mark?
I mean, obviously, I hope it will, as any reasonable human being does. But I can't say I'm convinced. I'm afraid. Obviously, you know, there are at least moves towards peace now. Obviously, a change in government in the United States. There seem to be some positive signs. Obviously, Trump is at least making noises that he wants the war to.
Oh, very loud noises.
Yeah, well, he does. But the point is, noises don't always lead to something happening. Obviously, we'll see whether he's able to carry through on his promises. Obviously, you know, he's already failed to bring an end to the war in 24 hours, but hopefully maybe 24 days, months. We'll see, won't we?
Well, he does have a partner in Kremlin at this point of time, and we'll see if he has a partner in Kyiv and some other capitals. Now, going back to the Great Patriotic War, it is remembered in Russia as a war of enormous, almost unimaginable sacrifice and loss. And it was also very important for the formation, I think, of Russian mass identity, much more than, let's say, the Bolsheviks' revolution. Do you think some sort of a clash between Russians and Ukrainians over the legacy of that war was inevitable?
I mean, I think like a lot of Western historians, I was a bit surprised that it didn't happen sooner, in a way. You know, the collapse of the Soviet Union happened relatively peacefully, didn't it, really? There's always been, under the surface, a bit of a tension between the western part of Ukraine and the rest of Ukraine and Russia. And I'm surprised that didn't surface in a more violent way, possibly even straight away in 91, 92.
Well, I remember when I was a student in one of the American universities, it was a long time ago, but even at that point of time, a lot of my American professors were predicting that there were going to be a war between eastern and western parts of Ukraine. At that point of time, I remember thinking that, you know, it was as if they were somewhat egging it on. Do you think that clash between the two neighborly states would have happened if it wasn't for the help of some of the western powers? I mean, they use this historical...
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, the West could obviously have taken a very different line towards Ukraine in recent years, rather than encouraging Ukraine to think about NATO. They could have said, Quite reasonable.
Think or to fantasize, because I mean, the Ukraine is still thinking about NATO. Well, the problem is that NATO doesn't want to think about it.
Now, not. But there was a time when, you know, obviously NATO was sort of riding high on after a wave of expansion, and obviously there were, I think I can possibly call them the hawks, if you like, who fantasized about taking that into really into the post-Soviet space, not just the Baltic republics. But, you know, Ukraine was almost a prize. And, yes, they could, you know, if saner voices had prevailed, then they could have said, no, you know, Ukraine is a step too far. Let's encourage Ukraine to be a sort of neutral zone, a sort of Finland during the Cold War type state. That would have been the ideal.
You have recently put together a very interesting edition, which is called A Handbook on Russian and Soviet Military Studies for Rutledge. And it covers a period from the early 19th century till this special operation in Ukraine, which I think is enough of a time span to show that the Russian military has some continuity, some traditions to it that, you know, don't change ideology to ideology or even an epoch to epoch. Who is it intended for? And do you think you would be able to set some of the records straight and perhaps educate some of the policymakers?
I mean, obviously, that was one of the hopes in my agreeing to write the book for Routledge. They asked me to produce it. I mean, I wanted to... I mean, there was this feeling in the West that because things didn't necessarily go as well for Russia at the beginning of the special military operation as might have been hoped, that Russia would just collapse. And to me, that was, you know, and some of my close colleagues, it was blatantly obvious that probably wouldn't happen. That, you know, in a way, it was fairly typical of Russian and Soviet wars for things to go reasonably badly at the beginning. And then there would be the sort of psychological digging in, and then things would pick up militarily. For Russia or in the past the Soviet Union, like, you know, in the Great Patriotic War, the initial shocks, things went very badly in the summer of 1941, but gradually, you know, there was this sort of mental digging in as well as, you know, military improvement, reorganization, all of these things. And ultimately, of course, Russia, the Soviet Union was victorious in the Great Patriotic
War. And I think in the book you also point out that this seems to be like a pattern almost for the Russian military, that they would have this sort of precipitous decline in the beginning, which would be followed by not only digging in, but I think some period of learning and adaptation. You know, they check, the reality check, so to say.
And more recently we saw that in Chechnya. You know, I was here, I was in Russia during the first Chechen War, and things went very badly. And of course, in the West, you know, observers want to see what they want to see. So they assumed that because it went badly at the beginning, it's going to continue to go badly, ignoring the fact that, you know, the Soviet army, the Russian army has always been a learning organization. So, for example, if we go back to the history of the Great Patriotic War, before the war, the Nazi Germany, observers looked at the war in Finland and they saw that it went very badly at the beginning. And then they chose to ignore the fact that there was a learning process. Obviously, ultimately, the Soviet Union forced Finland into peace, a peace treaty. And, you know, after that, there was, even under Stalin, there was some fairly serious soul-searching. They had a really interesting military conference after the war to study lessons, and they actually took them on board. As long as you didn't criticize Stalin, you could discuss fairly openly what the issues were, and they learned.
Now, if we apply that to the current circumstances, sure, in the beginning, the Russian offensive on Kyiv, on central Ukraine, perhaps wasn't as successful as some would have hoped, but I think there was also some period of adjustment. Now,
I mean, I'll just intervene here, because that's a kind of interesting question, and obviously only with time we'll know exactly what the intentions were. I mean, obviously, the fighting near Kyiv didn't go as well as it was hoped. But obviously, under the cover of the fighting in Kyiv, what was ignored in the West was that Russia did gain an awful lot of territory in the East. And I think that's often ignored. In the West, there was this focus on what happened near Kyiv. That was all they needed to know. Russia's going to do exactly the same thing carrying forward, and, you know, Ukrainian tanks will be in Moscow. It was the sort of fantasy that was going on in some Western circles. But it is important to remember that underneath the what was going on near Kiev, Russian troops were gaining a lot of ground in the east.
Mm-hmm. Now, can I ask you about that? Because, as I said, the Great Patriotic War was a war of enormous sacrifice, sacrifice of life, of treasure. I mean, the whole country was demolished. But I think during this, one of the reasons why the conflict in Ukraine is referred to in Russia as a special military operation is that the Kremlin leadership doesn't want to make it explicitly into a patriotic war. I mean, they rely on patriotism, but they don't want to create an impression that the whole country is at war. I want to ask you specifically about the use of resources in this war. Do you think that balance of giving the front what it wants or what it needs and also continuing with life, not as usual perhaps, but making sure that resentment does not spill into other sectors of life. Do you think Russia has been better at striking the balance?
I mean, that's been one of the more most successful elements of the special military operation, in the sense that, you know, a lot of Russians are able to carry on living pretty much as before whilst the war goes on. The fact that Russia hasn't had to use large numbers of conscripts in Ukraine, in the Donbass, has helped Russia not suffer the sort of psychological effects that the death of 18-year-old conscripts.
See, it's a tricky question because you do need to suffer some degree of psychological effect for the population to understand what it's dealing with and to contribute to the war effort and to be mobilized. I mean, it is ultimately a national undertaking. I mean, like, it's not just the Kremlin fighting this war. I mean, hopefully they are doing that for the sake of national interests. But I mean, I guess...
But you've got to find a balance.
Yes.
And I do think they found a balance. I mean, if you compare it to Ukraine, obviously, Ukraine is now suffering because they are so reliant on conscription. The psychological impact of relying on conscription is starting to impact the Ukrainian war effort in a way that the Russian population isn't being impacted.
Can you unpack it a little bit? So essentially what you're saying is that, you know, they're relying on young men who are poorly trained, who are being, you know, taken from the streets, and as opposed to, let's say, the Russian situation where the men, you know, sign up for the army and they receive good compensation and they can be sure that when they come back, they would have good career prospects. And if they don't come back, God forbid, you know, their families would be taken care of. Is that a matter of resources or is it also a matter of planning? I mean, like, how do you go about it?
I mean, obviously, it's both. Russia is larger than Ukraine. It's got a bigger population to draw on. Obviously, Russia...
But Ukraine was the one that wanted to, you know, strike on its own and made an initial move to define itself as an anti-Russia.
Right, but it's still...
It was its project
The statistical reality is Ukraine's much smaller. Ukraine lost a lot of some of its population early on in the war. They fled to Canada and other places, they simply don't have the manpower. I mean, obviously, Ukraine was also has also been inhibited until quite recently by the fact that they were trying not to mobilize people under 25. It's now they're trying to encourage people from 18 to 25 to join up. That's an age group, I think, that once you start having large numbers of 18-year-olds dying, then you start to risk psychological trauma than you do if it's men in their 30s and 40s volunteering, as you say, with a good salary and knowing that if they die, they're going to be benefits for their family.
Well, you will have mothers turning up against you, and that's a totally different threat. Now, Professor Hill, we have to take a short break right now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Thank you. there's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alexander Hill, Professor of Military History at the University of Calgary in Canada. Professor Hill, I mentioned some of these stereotypes in the beginning, which I hope your book will help to dispel. But one of the tropes or stereotypes we have in Russia is that one of the reasons why the fighting in Ukraine is so fierce is because you have Russians fighting against the Russians. And it's a little bit of, glorifying of the war effort on both sides. Is that actually accurate? When you look at the Ukrainian military, is it adjusting just as well, just as swiftly as the Russian military? Are they similar in terms of how they plan their operations, how they go about their psychologies, et cetera?
Yeah, that's obviously a big question. I mean, there are obviously similarities. The Ukrainian military saw itself as much more Western at the beginning of the war. And to some extent, I think they've walked back on that. There have been some criticisms within Ukraine of, you know, being too Western in their approach and having to modify things away from a sort of a Western version. In a way, the Russian military was more Western than it had been at the beginning of the war. I mean, it's understandable to some extent. Obviously, at the beginning of the new millennium, Russia was sort of more orientated towards counterterrorism and things like that. There was this move towards a sort of leaner, fitter military. There was a lot of talk about professionalization. Then, of course, with the reforms after the short war in Georgia, there was a lot of sort of focus on the idea of much more nimble military units, like battalion-level units, performing a lot of functions that in the past would have been performed by larger units.
I think I heard you say in another interview that perhaps some of the commanders in the Russian army are perhaps relieved that they have not been able to modernize according to Western standards as swiftly as they planned.
Yeah, no, I think that's a reasonable comment. Yeah, I mean, the reforms obviously on paper led to, you know, new organization and things like that. But it obviously it takes a lot longer to change a mentality. So that's a plus. I do think the mentality in the Russian armed forces hadn't changed away from conventional war to the degree that, say, it has in some Western militaries. I think things like the fact that Russia stockpiled a lot of conventional military equipment says a lot about a sort of Russian mindset that, there wasn't this willingness to give up on the idea that maybe there will be a big conventional war. Now, they did scrap some stuff. There was during the Surdykov reforms, they did scrap some tanks and things like that, but thankfully for the Russian war effort, they didn't scrap as many as they might have done.
I heard you say that there were a lot of these vintage weapons from tanks to artillery that found its use on the battlefield, not only on the Russian battlefield, but I think on the Ukrainian side as well. And I think we also have to mention some of the acumen or technical genius of the ordinary soldiers who made those stuff adaptable to the battlefield conditions. So perhaps, I mean, I'm desperately looking for some silver lining in this very desperate conflict, but I think some of on the human side, we've seen some of the very interesting developments as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that there's this contrast between the old and the new in the war in Ukraine, between this older equipment that's still serving. You know, if you watch what Russian news, you see this equipment in use. And of course, linking it with the modern technology. Obviously, everything's about drones. You know, you're spotting for artillery, it's drones. Drones are artillery in themselves. They're, you know, according to a lot of sources, they're the cause of the vast majority of casualties at times in the war. So you've got this contrast between sometimes weapons of the Soviet era and the new technology, the drones, obviously, the high precision, the precision munitions. It's this blend of old and new.
But it's also so symbolic because, I mean, at the end of the Cold War, I think both Russia and Ukraine turned their backs completely on the Soviet legacy without even wanting to study it carefully because, sure, there were many excesses of the Soviet time that made people want to walk away from it. But I think history drags us back and it drags us back on, into the battlefield of trying to,
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Russia turned away from the Soviet legacy as much as you might think, really. Well, I mean, obviously, memory of the... Even, I was here in the 90s, and yes, memory about the Great Patriotic War was not on the same level as it is now, but it wasn't lost. So I do think Russia has kept some of that legacy on which it's drawing now.
Now, let me ask you about the psychological aspect of it, because the Ukrainian project is ultimately is not about Ukraine in and of itself. It's about Ukraine as an anti-Russia and anti-Russia in all possible sense. Don't you think that it was very dangerous to attempt something like that? Isn't that essentially a nuclear option in terms of mass psychology to try to define your identity based on the anti-identity of your very powerful neighbor?
I mean, it's obviously not very sensible when you live next door to that neighbor. In that sense, it's not very wise. And obviously...
Well, it seems reckless, but...
Yeah, and obviously Ukrainian society in the West, there's this presentation that Ukrainian society is more unified than clearly it is. There's a failure to acknowledge the fact that, particularly in the East, there are many people who, they want to live culturally as Russians. They want the Russian church, they want to speak Russian. That's ignored in the West and played down. It's assumed that, all this is done under duress. So obviously, by trying to define themselves in opposition to Russia, that obviously inflamed tensions between the East and West in Ukraine and ultimately led to the rebellion after 2014, after the coup, the overthrow, the legitimately elected president.
Now, we'll be airing this interview shortly before the Victory Day celebrations in Russia on May 9th and the VE Day on May 8th. And as you know, initially, the difference in dates was pure chronology, but clearly right now, there's a lot of ideology there. What do you think the sites will be marking on that day? And is there anything in common that perhaps traces back from, those memorable days in 1945 when we all thought that, we prevailed over something very sinister?
Yeah, I mean, the Victory Day in the West has never been a big thing, really, in my lifetime, neither in the UK where I was born or in Canada. Obviously, there are groups that try and make it more prominent, but it's nothing like the event that it is in Russia. Now, it'll obviously be discussed in the media, and in the past, I think in the late 90s and the early 2000s, I think there was a consensus in the West that that it was a jointly won war, that the Soviet Union played a really important part in that victory. That, of course, in contemporary political circumstances is being very consciously played down. I mean, obviously Western leaders aren't going to the 9th of May celebrations and things like that, which is obviously, it's obviously unfortunate on many levels.
Well, but it's also understandable because for Russia, it was existential. I mean, it was a matter of life and death, not just for, large parts of, geographical parts of the, but for the entire country. I mean, whether or not your family, your loved ones got to live, that's what's celebrated. It's not just political.
Right.
It's the very basis of, I think, human perception. Anyway, I think this Victory Day would be somewhat special for Russia because it did achieve a minor yet significant victory in the changes that it is now seeing in Washington. I mean, I'm not ascribing it to Putin or to the Kremlin, but it is a great relief, I think, for the Russian leadership to see that the American leadership not only somewhat changed its position on Ukraine, but I think more broadly, the Americans are reappraising their policies towards the use of weapons, the use of military power for regime change. How significant is that? And do you think it may last beyond the Trump administration?
I mean, I have my doubts that it would last beyond the Trump administration, unfortunately, because history suggests otherwise. But, I mean, Trump obviously is going to be with us for a number of years. You know, he's in many ways a realist. That's a good thing. You know, I mean, what will Trump do next if he can't get agreement from Ukraine to accept the sort of realities that they have to accept if they're going to bring about some sort of peace? Then he's threatened to walk away. The Europeans are political leaders are talking about sustaining the war, the Ukrainian war effort, they say indefinitely, but obviously that would be a tall order for them. You know, spending more on their militaries, it's easy to say it and people won't get upset, but once you start cutting other things, then you might start to get more opposition. And I think, you know, there's a certain, obviously, people in Europe and North America aren't suffering. But in the way that, you know, obviously people don't like to see war going on, but they are nonetheless getting tired, I think, of the war. And there are many reasonable people who want it to come to an end.
Now, one of the things I often hear from Russian analysts is that the people in the West, especially decision makers in the West, are no longer connected with basic sense of fear. And that's why, and this is actually a very important emotion because it actually puts you in touch with reality. If you don't process fear correctly, maybe you are not able to adjust and learn the way the Russian side has been able. If there is another war, and there are talks about another war in Europe, how do you think it would be different from World War II?
Well, obviously, you know, one of the big, obviously there's the technology and all of that, but the big difference is obviously there weren't nuclear weapons at the very end of the Second World War, but only one or two. But at the end of the war in Europe, there weren't nuclear weapons. And, you know, I don't want to fearmonger, but, you know, if European leaders seem to think that they can push indefinitely and nothing will happen. Now, I'm not saying, obviously, nobody wants to even think about using nuclear weapons, but ultimately, we live in a world where you have to bear in mind that if things get out of hand, then ultimately nuclear weapons could be used.
That is if you do basic processing,
right? Right.
But if you don't, I mean, if you live in the world of slogans, and I think the Soviet project is a good example of that, if you only if you operate psychologically in the world of lozenges or slogans, then your connection with reality is indeed paralyzed. Now, very quickly, from your observations, are there any signs that not only the Russians and Ukrainians and perhaps to some extent Americans, but that the Europeans are also, you know, sort of adjusting and learning from the situation on the ground?
So you mean in a military sense?
In the military or political sense?
I mean, in the political sense, I don't really see it. In the military sense, obviously, European militaries are very interested in what's going on in Ukraine. And they, for example, recently, I think there was a news item about the Danish sending troops to Ukraine to learn about drone warfare. So obviously, there's an awful lot of interest in what is often seen as the changing nature of war. But as we discussed earlier, in a way, it's new elements with the old elements.
Yeah, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right.
That's human nature, ultimately.
Right, yeah.
Well, Professor Hill, we have to leave it there. It's been a great pleasure talking to you again. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.